This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Even if you never set foot in Dubai, you gotta hand it to them for what they've done here. They've built a city out of the sand in a generation. But there is a price tag to that progress. From American Public Media and live from Dubai, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
Greetings once again from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are here this week to look at the Middle East at work. Today is the 11th of March, everybody. The calendar says it's Tuesday, and it is for you and me. We are still a ways from our weekend. For migrant workers here, though, the Filipinos and South Asians who are building this city, it is actually the fourth day of their working week. Friday is the day of rest, their only day off. So they try to make the most of it. Often that's a trip to one of the souks down near Dubai Creek, markets where you can buy everything from spices and textiles to gold.
This 22-carat, 1 gram, 109.75.
It took me a minute to figure out what he was saying, but that's 109.75 dirhams per ounce, about 30 bucks American. 22-carat gold is the real deal, by the way. It's darker than we're used to back home. It's heavier, too. These guys kind of look down their noses at the 14-carat stuff. The stall was cramped, maybe 5 feet by 10, and crowded with workers.
For interview, it is better if you come tomorrow, because today is Friday. We have so many labor customers.
If you didn't catch that, he said, we have the labor customers, as in, get out of here, you're scaring away my business with that microphone. The business of this city right now is to grow, to get more people to come here, to set up offices, invest, and to build. And that is why we're here, because the world is coming. Those workers and how they spend their savings are important to the guy running that gold shop. They are nothing less than crucial to this city. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now on Dubai's supply of cheap labor.
At Jumeirah Beach, a group of well-heeled visitors boards a small bus for a property tour of Dubai.
And here we have here, in your right hand, it's Spanish design. For 4 bedrooms, it's 10 million.
Or $3 million. The property here sells at hefty Western prices, but for many of the migrant laborers who built it, the pay and conditions are third world. The air-conditioned comfort of the property tour contrasts sharply with the scene on the other side of town. Migrant workers fight to get on one of the few public buses to take them back to their labor camp. They've been in town buying food to supplement the rations provided by their employers. The angry bus driver shouts abuse at his unwelcome passengers.
Hey, stand up! Please.
This is where the workers' bus is heading. Sonapur, a vast, dusty labor camp on the outskirts of Dubai. Sonapur means city of gold, but here there are just acres of shabby, single-story concrete blocks. They house an astonishing number of people, at least 250,000 migrant workers, a large chunk of the country's total population of 2 million. Mohammed is a local photographer who always finds this place a shock when he comes here.
It's only about 4 or 5 miles away from the commercial district of Dubai. And, you know, even though it's that close, two worlds apart completely, you have majority of people here earning about less than $200 a month.
The workers are required to live in camps like this. I've come here to talk to some of them with Mohammed, who speaks Hindi. We've walked into one compound housing 5,000 labourers. We slipped through the gate, past the security checkpoint, which was unmanned, and into one of the hundreds of small rooms. So how many people living here?
Six men.
Six men. Yes.
It's quite small, isn't it?
It's very small. Yes.
About, 10 or 12 feet by 12 feet?
I'd say so. And to think that you have six people living here day in, day out. I mean, you just, look, there's, three bunk beds, you know, sleeping two each. It's a very incredibly cramped room, and they all have their meals here. A place where two people can maybe just stand up. And this is where dinner for six people is made in these different buckets and pots and pans.
But the labourers told Mohammed their biggest problem is money. They earn less than $40 for a basic 72-hour week. That's 12 hours a day for 6 days.
They feel like they're being treated the same way as animals are being treated. This life is very, very hard here.
Their life has become harder because Dubai's currency, the dirham, is pegged to the dollar. The slump in the US currency has dragged down the value of their wages. They send less money home to support their families, the main reason for coming to Dubai. Many feel trapped here.
He says he has taken a loan to come here, so how will he go back without paying the loan? There'll be a problem.
One of the young men in this room is 23-year-old Shamsir Singh. He's supporting his mother and seven siblings back in the Punjab while struggling to pay off $1,800 he borrowed there. It could be many years before he can afford to go home.
As far as he's concerned, he says life for him is over.
At 23?
At 23, that's right.
Some of the workers are better off than others. Some of the European contractors pay more and provide better facilities than some of the Middle Eastern companies. The government of Dubai is trying to improve matters overall. It's drafting a modern labour law, laying down minimum standards of working and living conditions. It's even mulling over a minimum wage. But Chris Davidson, who lived for several years in this city and has written two books about it, says the sharp contrast between rich and poor is inevitable.
Dubai, trying to become this global city, has essentially brought two sides together. It's created an incredibly stark fault line between first world and third world.
But the fault line is moving. As the Indian economy booms, more Indian workers are finding jobs at home. And word has spread about some of the problems in Dubai. It's becoming much tougher for this city to recruit labour in South Asia. It's having to look further and further afield, to China, to Vietnam, and to the Philippines. In Dubai, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The fact is that for every Indian or Pakistani who decides to leave Dubai, for every Bangladeshi who figures, as Stephen said, that their opportunities are going to be better at home, there are dozens or hundreds of others who will gladly replace them here. Marketplace's Scott Tong met one of them in Manila.
Step inside Jose Garcia's house, and you hear this. Many locals say that's the sign of a true Filipino. Chuckle on the outside, even if you're desperate on the inside. 43-year-old Garcia chats up his wife and two kids, and then he shuffles across the room alone. He says he's worried.
I want money to support my family. Only support my family.
Garcia is a carpenter, just like his father. He can only find temp jobs in Manila, so he's underemployed, along with 20% of the country's 90 million people. So next month, Garcia plans to leave for Dubai to help build a shopping mall and double his monthly salary.
My salary here in the Philippines, not enough, because 1 month, almost $200.
Almost so $200.
Abroad, two times, double.
That's $400 a month, plus free room and board in Dubai. He plans to send half of it home so his daughter Jana can start college. She's been waiting.
2 years, or almost 3 years, because I graduated in high school in 2005.
This will be her dad's second tour of the Middle East. He moved to Saudi Arabia when she was 5 and came back to see her turn 13. Garcia's overseas wages bought everything in this modest concrete house. The TV, the couch, the house itself.
Still,
Even his son Mark's basketball. He's tearing around now with some 20 cousins. And that's part of the problem in the Philippines. Too many people chasing not enough jobs. So every year, the country exports 1 million workers. Economist Ernesto Pernia of the University of the Philippines says remittances prop up the nation's economy, but at a huge cost.
The country cannot continue to educate its citizens and then just supply them to overseas market. They're also needed here.
The thing is, there just aren't enough domestic jobs to keep them. If Filipinos are being pushed overseas, countries like Dubai are pulling them. At this Manila job fair, mechanical engineer Roy Montalbo considers it his choice destination.
If you want to go to Middle East, only the Dubai, UAE, United Arab Emirates place only. Other than that, no.
Dubai's image here is of good jobs, lax immigration laws, and a good lifestyle. Unlike, say, Saudi Arabia, Filipinos can attend mass in Dubai and drink booze.
There are even prostitutes.
That's overseas recruiter Victor Fernandez.
Of course, it is not allowed, but they just become callous to it, and it seems like Los Angeles.
Grassy here. Babe! Yeah, how's my baby doing?
There's even a popular Filipino film about the experience. Naturally, it's called Dubai. But the movie also highlights the risk of broken relationships for couples who spend years apart. Recruiter Fernandez says there are other dangers, like human trafficking and withheld wages. But he says Filipinos tend to ignore them.
There are a lot of Filipinos still working in Iraq, and they will say, this will not happen to me. But when you try to ask them, why don't you go leave, because there is now danger there, they will say, do you have a job for me in Manila? Because if not, I would rather take my reserve.
Carpenter Jose Garcia plans to take his chances too and leave his neighborhood once again.
Maybe not pay, but I'm not afraid. I will try.
The next day, though, he gets a text message from his recruiter. He failed his physical. Jose's chest x-ray showed inflammation from an old bout with TB. No Dubai, no college for his kids. His son now wants his dad to get to the Middle East illegally. It's risky, but he thinks it's the only hope for his family to get a decent paycheck. In Manila, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've got pictures from Stephen's trip to the labor camp and from Scott in the Philippines on our website. It's marketplace.org. Dubai imports its construction workers, its bankers, too, to work in the private sector. The locals do government work. Problem is, those government jobs aren't so plentiful anymore, so most Emiratis don't work at all. Across the broader Gulf region, it's a similar story. Unemployment is near 15%, way worse if you only count people under 30. As the economy of this region keeps growing, and it will, disparities between the native population and those who are just visiting could become a problem. I sat down last week with labor consultant Kito DeBoer, and I asked him what the leadership in the Gulf ought to do about that.
The first is it has to get its education system right. The current education system is failing by any objective measure. The second thing that they need to do is to get the labor and immigration rules coherent and consistent with giving their citizens priority when it comes to employment, and only bringing in those people who have got a distinctive contribution to make to economic development.
Characterize the labor market here, the Gulf specifically.
The Gulf countries are unique. They have a flexible immigration policy where it's pretty easy to get in, though it's getting more difficult. But they have very rigid labor markets, which means that once you're in on a specific job, it is difficult, sometimes impossible, to change jobs. You get locked in.
Let me get back to education for a second. What is it about the education system here that is failing the population?
The way that people get taught in the Gulf is they get taught by rote. They get reinforced to recite what they were told. Very traditional form of learning. I think many societies go through that stage. But it doesn't advance critical thinking. Many people would also, many employers would also say that a number of basic skills are underdeveloped, which makes people hard to be employed. But there is not a mechanism that has yet been developed in many of these economies to actually reconcile and come to a national agreement about what it is we actually want our schools to teach.
Labor policy here has been the way it is so that this place could grow. Education policy has been the way it is because of societal norms. Mm. Where will the impetus come from for change in either one of those areas in the next 5 or 10 years?
When you speak to the rulers in the region, the one thing that they will have clear agreement around is that they see the number one priority for their countries moving forward to be education. By 2020, the GDP per head, the amount of wealth per head, per person in this region, will be where Germany and Japan, amongst the wealthiest countries in the world, are today. The real risk is that if you have an economy with a wealth per head of Germany or Japan, but an educational system where the educational attainments are on the level of Ghana, then you have a major societal problem, because the majority of their people in their society will not be able to gain effectively through their own labor the benefits of what's happening to their economy. They have to find a way of getting their own societies to be the primary beneficiaries of that.
Kieran de Boer is managing director for McKinsey here in the Middle East. Mr. de Boer, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
Coming up, obligation and opportunity.
Should we stay in the U.S., where each of us has a job we love? Or should we return to Egypt and pass on our skills and all that we've learned here in the U.S.?
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks jumped on Wall Street today. Oil hit another record high. But gold took a bit of a dive, trading at about $972 an ounce. That's down from the all-time high of $995 last week. Those sky-high prices are great news for commodity traders, especially here in Dubai. The city's long been a key marketplace for gold from the smuggling days years ago. In 2005, it launched a gold futures exchange. Seemed like a good idea at the time. Last year, the price of gold rose more than 30%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. And by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Missed anything from our Middle East series? You can listen to the entire show or individual stories with no special audio player required. Download the show and take it with you. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
United Arab Emirates was formed in 1971 after a long occupation by the British, but Westerners have returned with gusto. Dubai's work opportunities attract businessmen and their wives. The blogosphere has slammed these ladies who lunch with the unflattering moniker Jumeirah Jane. This pampered expat, labeled for the exclusive neighborhood Jumeirah, is a gal with a lot of time on her hands to shop, spa, and do coffee. Sounds like she keeps pretty busy to me. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are live from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates this week. I got a ride back to my hotel last week from a guy who lives here in town. We drove past the new house he's building in an upscale expat neighborhood nearby. I think he said he put $3 million down on the place. He's hoping it's going to be finished this summer. If it is, he's one of the lucky ones. Real estate here has been open to foreigners since 2002. Speculators and would-be Dubai transplants have been coming ever since. And developers are having trouble keeping up with them. Marketplace's Sean Cole has our story.
In Dubai, apartment buildings sell out before they're even built. In fact, that's how they're built. Construction is paid for by the buyers. Most of these buildings aren't completed on time. And Reza Mamadi, a high-tech entrepreneur from Iran, didn't want any part of that. So he picked a building that was practically finished, but he still had to wait. And he doesn't know why.
I really don't know what to do. I mean, okay, so you sit and until when? You wait forever?
Mamadi has lived in Dubai for 5 years, during which time rents have risen to like New York prices. So to save a little money, he bought an apartment in Goldcrest Views 1. All the buildings here have names like that. He says it was 90% done when he looked at it in February of last year.
Flooring was done, cabinets were there, everything was there. Then just the ceiling was remaining.
Two bedrooms, 900,000 dirhams, which is about 250 grand US. He took out a loan for the down payment, and the developer said he'd have the keys in a month or two. Or three. Four.
First, they were saying, okay, we are waiting for this approval, that approval, water and electricity, security check. You know, always there is something.
In August, they said December, and in December, the lease on the villa he was living in ran out. So he crammed himself and his wife into a little studio.
I mean, move out from a two-bedroom villa to a small room. I mean, imagine my wife. I mean, how much angry she is. Still, she cannot stand it anymore. I have just this just extra payment each month for nothing.
Mamadi took me to see the nothing.
You see that one?
In the middle.
Yeah, in the middle.
It's in an area called Jumeirah Lakes Towers, which is hardly a neighborhood at this point. There's nothing but construction around Mamadi's building. 79 high-rises are planned for this area. And if last year is any indicator, most of them will be late. I read one report that said 50% of the projects in Dubai were delayed in 2007.
Now that we're past 07, I think delays were about as high as 80%.
80%?
80%.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Rania Afifi wrote that report. She's a strategist at Schwa Capital in Dubai. She says everyone's competing for limited labor and materials. Plus, everything that makes a building go, roads, utilities, whatever, all that's late. Meantime, there are lots of Reza Mamadis who want to buy here, she says, and they need to cut Dubai some slack.
When your economy, you know, grows at 53% over, you know, just a few years, and your population grows at, you know, a similar rate over 3 or 4 years, that's a lot to absorb within a year or two. People need to understand that it's just a matter of time, and you know, Dubai will come around.
Meanwhile, Reza Mamadi is still out tens of thousands of dollars. He thought of demanding compensation from the developer, Masjid Giga International, or MGI. I went to talk to them about that.
It is all interconnected, you know, this construction business is not a one-man show, you know, it's all...
Yusuf Choksi is director of projects for MGI. He says the building was finished in March last year, and the power and water and approvals, all that really did take a long time. He says he ended up laying the power cables at his own expense.
In all honesty, if they are going to get the compensation, so we should also get compensated.
Well, but, I mean, did you really think you suffered as much as they did?
Can I tell you one thing, Sean? Their suffering is negligible to what...
But you're a company. I mean, there are people...
I'm a company, not true. But they are going to get better than that what they have thought about. They're going to get a beautiful swimming pool. Have you seen our swimming pool?
No, I haven't.
I think let's go after this.
You wanna?
I will take you there.
That'd be awesome.
I will show you my project.
Actually, the marketing guy ended up taking me there.
Rooftop swimming pool. We do have gym, sauna, everything.
The view from the roof was pretty great. And then I asked if I could see Mamadi's apartment on the 23rd floor. It was all ready for him.
Fitted with everything.
And it is pretty nice. Lots of windows, couple bathrooms. Mamadi's seen it too. And after all this, he wasn't that impressed.
I really think it's not worth it. That's mine. So it's not my dream.
Anyway, the apartment's his now. They finally handed the building over last month. But one of the buyers still wants compensation, a guy in the UK who plans to rent his place out. He hired a lawyer, and he's got a bunch of other buyers involved. But Mamadi's begging off. After all, he says, he has to live there. In Dubai, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
You want to see what Reza Mamadi got for his 900,000 dirhams? We've got pictures to go with Sean's story on our homepage. The Middle East at Work is online at marketplace.org. We've been hearing this week from people who've come from all over the world to work here. Some have come to Dubai, others to different parts of the Middle East. Plane tickets work both ways, though, and human capital is a big export for some countries in this region. Commentator Mona El-Tahawi says the decision to leave comes with mixed emotions.
I'm an Egyptian-born journalist who moved to the US in 2000. My brother and his wife, both physicians, arrived a year earlier. Whenever I travel from New York City, where I live, to their home in Ohio, there's one question guaranteed to start a never-ending conversation. Should we stay in the US, where each of us has a job we love? Or should we return to Egypt and pass on our skills and all that we've learned here in the US? We circle the question constantly. We're unable to decide, yet unable to drop a subject which surely troubles many others who've also left their countries of birth for opportunities elsewhere. The question is especially poignant for my brother and his wife. They were the benefactors of a free medical school education in Egypt. State-run universities are free for Egyptians. But the reason they left Egypt is one of the reasons they hesitate to return. A rigid hierarchy and lack of opportunities sideline young people with ambition. They must wait years for positions my brother and his wife have found here in the US. Every now and then, we hear of a brave soul or two who took the plunge and returned to Egypt. But we just as often hear of how frustrated they became at the bureaucracy and that stubborn hierarchy. They complain of hours wasted in government offices to finish paperwork and of the territorial nature of new co-workers worried by the skills of the newly returned Egyptians. Many quickly give up and leave the country once again. We like to think there are other ways we can benefit Egypt and our fellow Egyptians. Occasionally, a young Egyptian doctor or journalist recently arrived in the US contacts me or my brother. We do all we can to introduce them to our network and give them the kind of help which made our transition here easier. If they choose to return to Egypt, then hats off to them. If they stay, I'm sure they too will start their own never-ending conversation.
Mona El-Tahawi writes a syndicated column. No matter where you are or where you work, take a second and send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
Dubai's not a sportsman's paradise just yet, but it's trying. You might have heard Andy Roddick won the tennis championships here this past weekend. Tiger Woods was in town for the Desert Classic last month, and on the 29th of this month, the world's richest horse race, the Dubai World Cup, is going to be run at the Nahd El Sheba racetrack just outside town.
Horse number 12, race 4, Vigilant, is a non-runner.
But when the millionaires aren't here, the track's a great place for a family night out. No booze, remember, we're in an Islamic country. And no betting. Well, not exactly. There are racing forms.
This is a selection for a horse.
And there is money to be won.
This ticket is free. If your selection comes first and wait for your name, if it comes in draw, then you can be the lucky person.
Lucky to the tune of 400 or 500 dirhams, 100 or 2 US. Maybe a couple of thousand dirhams, God willing.
Yeah, we have luck, I win. Maybe, inshallah, I win.
Playing the ponies, inshallah. That is Dubai, and that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 416 points. That is more than 3.5%. The Dubai General Index lost 42 points, 0.7%. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, a conversation from the corner office from a different corner of the world.
I'm Saudi, but I'm also an Arab Muslim in the Middle East who is looking for change.
Sheikh Waleed, the CEO of MBC. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
وسائل الإعلام الأمريكية.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.